This is Fred Wooden, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 12th of December, 2011. Fred Wooden, Part 2. Tell me about building the base at Danco Island. Was it a tough job?
Not really, no. It wasn't, a tough job. It was a Bolton Paul design when they had, obviously, a good blueprint, etc. And, of course, we had Dick Foster, who was a member of Costangs. There are quite important builders in all sorts of buildings and properties. And he was more or less like a quantity surveyor as well. Mm. So he knew the actual building sequences that should take place one after another. So he was able to organise the work party into sort of the, what each person should be doing or help, etc., in one way or another. So he was very, very good at that, Dick. And, of course, we had to do the foundations first, which was a fairly difficult work because it was in a rock debris situation, plus probably actual rock underneath the debris, and that had to be cleared, and we had to make concrete pillars to raise the floor up about a foot or 2 foot, more or less, so that you get an air current underneath the hut itself. Otherwise, you get a build-up of snow, and that which builds up underneath the building, and it becomes an embarrassment because it blocks up the ventilation and the well-being of the actual the floor itself. And that was very hard work. In fact, working with moisture and cement meant that down south, where it was very extremely cold, you've got cracked hands, and your thumbs especially, and fingerprints on your thumbs, etc., were badly cracked. So that was painful, and once you got over that sort of thing, and you were able to dispense with the idea of having cement, which was the actual big culprit, I think. We come to the woodwork and things like that, which was much more pleasant to work with. And, of course, it was all had to be cut to size and then fitted properly over the actual the beams, etc., and the floor joists. And the flooring had to be a diagonal sort of thing for strength. And that was all done in quite good order. And meanwhile, we had to sleep in our tents and in sleeping bags, etc., nowhere else to go. And meals were actually cooked in what we made of a little bothy with all the packing cases and tarpaulin sheets over the top as a roof sort of thing, and a bar ladder hanging up where we could eat our meals during the day. And do all the cooking, etc. So that was a little nice little warm little spot. And then once the flooring was on and all the insulation on the ground section was done, we put up the framework, which was all itemised and labelled as to where it should go and what it should fit into. Like tongue and grooving, where instead of having to screw or nail up structures, it just slotted together like a big jigsaw puzzle. And once all the framework was up, then the walling could go up with the insulation, all the rubberoid and things like that for waterproofing. You could get the ceiling joists up and put the floor on for the attic and the roof over the top, so make it sort of watertight and windproof to a certain extent, We didn't put the windows in and doors in until very late. So it was windblown, but it was a shelter. And we all mucked in, sort of thing, and we worked probably all the daylight hours that we could usefully employ. And by the time, I think it was March, in actual fact, all the main housing and the roof and all that, like the waterproofing, including the windows, I think, and doors, were all in by the time that the Shackleton called for a last port of call before going back to UK. So we were quite content. Bill Johnson was very pleased anyway that we'd got so far ahead and got the work done, and he was able to leave knowing full well that we were hopefully safe and sound.
So how long did it take then to get to a relatively finished state, 2 or 3 months?
Well, the actual finished state, you mean the actual the time we got all the beds up and things like that? It was probably another month of sort of work. We had a lot of stuff to dig out of fallen snow and things like this, and to find out where what fitted what and where certain things were, and certain things obviously were missing because either they hadn't been put on the ship in the first place or they were buried. And we just sort of did without them, as it were, and got by. And so it was about a month or so. It's more or less peaceful sort of work that wasn't sort of demanding in hardships. We just jogged on. Everybody knew what they were doing. Of course, everybody had to take turns in cooking for 1 week, which did help in many respects. But it meant that if you had split fingers, for example, and things like this, you had a week's respite, really, that you could make them better. It's anyway, I think we all really enjoyed it, making our own home.
You were there, of course, to do survey work.
That's right.
And that, I guess, was somewhat frustrating, was it?
It was frustrating because being on an island meant that all you could do was to work locally. There was very few landing points anywhere near the base that you could work from and move inland. The landing point was there, yes. And once on there, you couldn't move more than about 20 or 30 feet, which is not very good if you want to do some survey work. So it really meant that my survey work, or our survey work, was that having a plan of the area so that the Admiralty or whatever ship was in the area could do soundings and find out where the best anchorage position was. And so this is what I was engaged on. And of course, once we got that sorted out, then we could perhaps move further into the Anver Bay or Paradise Harbour area, for example, or at Wilhelmina Bay, or even into the Gerlach Strait area to do further extensions to what would more or less be a shipping map or chart. The idea of having to travel long distances and take sun observations and things like that didn't exist, because once the actual base hut had had its astroposition fixed, then any triangulation and survey work from that fix would be quite enough. You didn't have to do a second one. And if you had travelled long distances, then that would have been necessary. You had to do more than one astro fix. But no, the base survey was very, very local in many respects.
Was there no way you could get into the interior of the island?
Well, not really, no. We had several attempts to try and force a route, but they all led to one point, which was, we later recorded the dame for, because that was it. We got up to, 4,000 odd feet up there, and looked over the edge there, and there was about a 50-foot drop, and there was a sharp arete running right up to the main platform. If we could have got across that arete, we would have got up into the spine of the Antarctic Peninsula, up to what we called then the Forbidden Plateau. It was one of those frustrating things. Every point that we turned to led to that one position, the downfall. Why Bill didn't see that from the sea in Amber Bay, perhaps he never visited it, I don't know, but he just went on hearsay. But certainly that there was no route up from where we built the base.
Which meant, of course, that Danko Island as a British Antarctic Survey base was rather short-lived, wasn't it?
It was short-lived because it, even for Met observations, it was surrounded by high mountains. it had a sort of a local climate, so that was no good for the overs picture of what the Antarctic Peninsula was doing. So it was very, very local. It was a shame, really, because it was, as far as the base hut was concerned, it was quite a good hut. And we had a penguin rookery. We could have eggs and penguins and things like that. Plenty of seals up in the area as well for the things. But, it was sad to see it go, but there we are.
Let's talk about one or two highs and lows. And there's one low where one of your colleagues, John Kettley, got a message.
Oh, yeah.
In October 55.
Yeah, poor old
56.
John. I think he lived at Witten in Surrey, I think. Mm. But John was a youngster. He was the youngest member of the party. And he had red hair, old ginger. And he was a very rock and roll type of lad. And he wasn't, an accomplished surveyor, in actual fact. He was, he had survey knowledge, but he I don't know where he got it from, in actual fact, whether he was for the services or not. I don't know. I never queried that one. But he was good at plane tabling, which once the positions of certain points are fixed, you could build on those and make the actual map on a sheet of paper. And that was John's idea. And he was a sort of a lively lad. And of course, we never thought anything was wrong at all. And one day, we had a coded message come through, which I took down. And of course, I didn't have the knowledge to and decipher it, and of course Dick eventually deciphered it, and it was unfortunate that poor John's mother had died, in actual fact. So of course it's one of those things that the base members feel very acutely, because when it happens to one of your pals, and you don't know how he's going to react, and of course John being a youngster, it was even more so. We didn't know how he was going to react, but we sort of gave him a free rein, said, well, right, if you want to go up into the dark room and or anything like that, or hide or what, you're welcome to help wherever we can give it, you see. So John took himself up to the dark room with his radio, and he played one of the United States stations for music, etc. And he stayed up there a couple of days, in actual fact. We took his food up to him, which he ate all right. And after that, he came down more or less as right as rain as you'd hope for, really. He'd accepted the result. And we all sent a message to his dad from the base, expressing our condolence, etc. And John had a reply back. So I think he more or less accepted the fact that that was going to happen anyway. We didn't know. I mean, his mum had been ill for some time, so I should imagine John must have been aware of it and realised that it's likely to happen while he was down south. But yes, he was a good lad. He really went on to Ambrose Island and for his second year.
You had a surprise visit in from the member of the royal family.
That's right, yeah, well, that was a surprise too, because
Duke of Edinburgh.
We didn't know much about what was going on, obviously, and there was a rumour that there would be a visit of a ship, etc., somebody on board. We didn't know whether it was going to be the governor or anything like that, you see. And so we carried on our local survey business, and I was with, I think, Pidge Palmer, I think, our radio up in our little boat, and I was going out to the nearest island, and I could hear this aircraft overhead, and I thought, well, I don't know whether that's the Argentine Air Force up there or what it is, and they kept... This noise kept buzzing around, and all of a sudden I saw over the top of Romsey Island a helicopter. And obviously he was searching for something. We didn't know where it came from or anything. And we carried on to this island and to carry out the survey work. And all of a sudden it came down and flew over the top of us, several feet as it were. And we realised that something was up. So... We more or less indicated for us to return to the island, so we made a dash back to the base hut, and he had landed on the beach alongside the base hut, and there was a naval lieutenant pilot there, and we later learned that when we had conversation with him that he was looking for the base hut, so that he knew where to get the John Briscoe could... land the Duke of Edinburgh, and that was he came ashore shortly afterwards in the, I think it was the following day, I think, I'm not sure, but he came ashore, came in to see us, it was just the three of us, because our three members were at Wilhelmina Bay, and he wanted to know all the story of how the base was built, etc., and wanted to know what was going on. He was very, very pleasant. And, of course, he left shortly afterwards, and I think they went on to Port La Croix. But, yes, it was quite good.
Did you dress up?
No, funny enough, it's one of those strange things that we don't always realise. He was saying in the mess deck there, he said he's glad he came on this visit because he didn't have to wear a tie. It was, you don't think about these things, that but people having to dress up for the occasion, and he didn't have to dress up on this occasion. It was very, very human. Yeah, good.
At the end of the season, you all left Baso. Was it then decided that it wouldn't be used again the following season?
No, it was used the following season. We left all our results and things like that too. The incoming staff, as it were. And we had hoped that the base hut would continue as a sort of a refuge if it wasn't being used at all, because any port of storm, I think, in those areas is a great help. We don't know when expeditions or whatever it is, people travelling down there would... need a place of comfort. But I think the actual base hut itself had deteriorated. I don't know why. I can understand why our base hut at Jay, at Prospect Point, deteriorated, but I can't understand why the one at the base O, Danko Island, deteriorated. It could be the fact that... the storms, in actual fact, ruined the roof insulation or protection. I don't know. It they decided in any way they would keep the base much further south, base W. They would keep the Bolton Poor Hut, that one. Obviously, it was in much colder climate than the base O one. Therefore, it probably had greater chance of being kept in sort of less expense, as it were, and keeping it watertight, as on snowtight, whatever you like to call it. Mm-hmm. But no, it's just the base of J, the Prospect Point one, the base hut, a lot of the woodwork, that the structure of the hut itself was immersed in seawater when the ship had presumably a gash, actually, I suppose, in the plating. And a lot of it got soaked with salt water. And of course, knowing what salt does, it absorbs moisture from the air anyway. So this could have caused the rotting of the wood, actually, in the Prospect Point one. But that's why they decided to get rid of that one as well.
Let's get ourselves to Base J, Prospect Point.
Yeah.
You were all shipped out there. And basically, it was the same process again, trying to find somewhere
put the hut. Well, I don't know. That was already carried out and done for us. I mean, by the time I got down there, they'd done the concrete pillars, or at least they'd prepared a lot of the work for concrete pillars. So I came in after several days of them having started and having sighted the place. For a start, I don't know who sighted it, for example, or whether any preparation has been done to find out if there was a route inland. It's one of those oddities, because when we tried to find a route inland, we found it impossible. So it's a moot point of why it was there. It could be that one another case where the ship had stuff on board and had to get rid of it and said, well, we'll put it down to the nearest place that we can find a place to site it and hope for the best. I don't know. We've never understood that one. It's anyway, it's one of those areas that's much more open, and the temperature, the annual temperature is obviously a lot lower than they were at Danko Island. So we had sea ice, which meant that we could use the dogs that were allocated to us for distant travelling, and this gave us a sort of a new lease of life. We had not exactly freedom, but we had movement of away from the base area, which we didn't get at base O. And so consequently, we had a lot of work with the inner coastal area and the outer islands. Now, this coincided with the naval party that had been working in Ambers Island. They wanted to move south into Grandidia Channel, which we were working in. So I think behind the scenes, it was agreed that we would join the naval party for the summer season, and we would work together as a naval unit instead of a FIDS unit, having done our FIDS work during the winter. And hey presto, that's basically what happened. Thank goodness, because that's the best part of my life down there. We were under naval command and not under a FIDS command. And having been very pro-naval, I suppose, that may have helped. But it was very good. John Wynne Edwards, he also a local man, and actually he comes from Hayling Island. And we kept it all very local, as it were.
Was there a distinct difference in the ethos between FID management and Navy management?
I would say that Naval Command was much more in control of events, put it that way. I don't know whether that was just because of the different type of work that we were involved between Base J and Base O. Well, one was local and one was not local. The idea of transport was one thing. Where we had dogs in the winter and they were launched in the summer, we only had small boats, actually, in Faitho. And it meant that there was a lot more danger in using a small boat than it was in perhaps travelling on sea ice and naval launch. I don't know, mind you. We did nearly come across on sea ice, where the ice couldn't have been very thick. We used to go through with an ice chisel. We used to go straight through the ice, so we had to be careful where we trod. And, of course, always on skis to lessen the pounds per square inch on the surface of the area, which was another thing.
So was the surveying from Prospect Point, from Bay Strait, was always done on sea ice with dogs? You never got into the interior again?
No, never got into the interior at all in Bay Strait. It was oriented to, hydrographic survey requirements, where the control points could be sighted by using sextants instead of theodolites. When you're sounding on a ship, you're basically on open sights with a sextant, which is more or less held horizontally. Therefore, your line of vision is something about 30 feet above sea level in the distance, which meant that your survey stations, ideally, would be about that distance above sea level at any particular landing point in the area. Whereas normal survey techniques, it doesn't matter how high up, it could be 4,000 feet up, providing you could see the actual point with a theodolite, it didn't matter. You couldn't reach it with a sextant, because you'd have to tip the sextant up to try and see it. No, it was basically ideal situation for naval hydrographic surveying. That's how I would think. We were fortunate that not only did we have to climb up mountainsides to do our survey stations, but we could put it on headlands, which are above sea level, which meant that we could visit more spots with less hardships. And I think it gave us a greater sort of happiness, as it were, in being able to do the job that we were sent down there for. It just, way things turned out, perhaps. I don't know. We were a guardian angel again looking after us.
You say it was much colder at Prospect than it was at Dancoats. How did that manifest itself?
We're expected to be cold in the Antarctic, yes. but there are some of the temperatures we didn't expect. I mean, we went down to minus 24 on one of the survey trips.
That's Fahrenheit.
And that's right. And you could see the steam rising up off the ice, the sea ice, etc. And that was jolly cold. I mean, even in the base hut, I mean, you couldn't touch any metal or anything like that. Otherwise, it hurt your fingers. We didn't get that at Baso. And Baso was more or less, if you think of an extremely cold Scottish temperature during winter, that is about what we had to put up with at Baso. It was not exactly what they call the banana belt, but it was cold, no question about it. But nothing like the temperatures you get further south. I mean, it gets even colder much further south, Alexander Island and places like that. Fossil Plus, they went down way below what was happy to sustain. You have to dress up in really thick clothing for that. But no, basically we got by. We got acclimatised, which is another aspect of what certain people at home here don't realise. That, I mean, to see anybody walking down the Antarctic, you know, with an open-neck shirt on or something like that, you just couldn't believe. And yet, you didn't feel cold. This is it. The body had accepted that lower temperature as being normal. It's
But you had to keep busy, didn't you?
Pardon?
You had to keep busy.
Oh, yeah, you had to keep moving. Mind you, when there was no wind at all, that is slightly a different story. It's one of those strange aspects that I never experienced before. There was no breeze in one occasion, and you could strip off almost bare skin. And I carried on digging a snow pit to dig out some stuff at Base O, for example, and didn't feel cold at all. And directly a breeze comes up, that's it. You're rushing for putting on warm clothing and things like that. But when there's no wind, it's quite strange. You don't expect it.
There was quite a substantial sledging survey trip in August of that year, 57, August, 20 days, August 5th to 25th, 57, with two sledges.
That's right.
Yes. You were on one of those. Tell me a bit about that expedition.
Well, this is one of those things that we realised that we wanted to control over the Grand Indian Channel, certainly the southern part of it. That was a part of our responsibility from Prospect Point, and that meant that the Ada Islands had to be visited and the inner coastal area had to be visited. So Ron Miller, who was our base leader, devised that there should be a party doing the Ada Islands and a party doing the inner islands. Now, on the way up, we had to sort of erect our survey stations, and on the way back, we had to observe them to make sure that each party knew exactly where the stations were. We had to exchange partners at the far end of the journey before returning back southwards. So this is what happened, that we went up the coastal area, and Brian actually went up the coastal area. And when we got up to the northern end, we swapped partners and came back down south and observing all the way with Theodolite observing. And so, fun enough, we arrived both at the base station on the same day, we didn't expect. Now, during that time there, we hoped to be in contact with radio, but one thing, our radios didn't always work. So it was just more or less what we saw through the satellite, whether or not the coastal party or the inner area party, the outer area party, rather, were actually on their site doing the observations. And one thing we did notice, although we were about, 20 miles apart, we knew that the dogs in our team could hear the dogs of the other team further out to sea. Their hearing must be absolutely extreme. They used to constantly be looking out to the sea and as they were running along. And it was fairly obvious to us they could hear the other dogs. It was quite strange.
Was this when you had air support? You had some aerial photographs taken?
We didn't know about that, in actual fact. We knew that that the hunting area survey had been flying over the area, but we had no idea what they'd taken or what they needed to control the photographs. In actual fact, on the Grand Indian Channel, they had an open area there that they didn't get any photographs at all. And when we come to do the actual map at the Overseas Survey, we had to borrow some of the detail from an Argentine map. But it's one of those things that we could have done with more information of what was happening on the grander scale. I keep, you know, saying this about our pre-training and things like that. It wasn't, to me, enough to be 100% safe, as it were. We were just left to our own devices. And this is it. It was only when we got back home we realised that the area that we'd been working in, putting all the control down, we had an air photo cover for. And normally what we were doing while we were down there, we were providing information so that you could do a survey at ground level without having recourse to air photographs. Had we known that air photographs were being used, our technique would have been slightly different, or should have been slightly different, but this way.
What went wrong? Why weren't you aware of that, would you say?
Well, we knew the photographs were taken because now if you have an air photograph, you want to be able to put that in its correct position. And ideally, to put it in the correct position, you want to have two photographs that are stereoscopic.
Yes.
So in that stereoscopic part of those two photographs is where the actual ground survey point should be. Well, we didn't know where those points would be at all. We were just making survey points to suit ourselves at ground level, which would be suitable perhaps for hydrographic survey. We had no idea whether the points that we were supplying would be useful for air photographs. So there was that mix that we didn't know what was going on.
And you didn't know because the Navy and FIDS weren't, and all the Navy and Huntings weren't talking to each other? What was the... Did you ever get to the bottom of
that? Well, they were talking, but the point is you had to have a visual arrangement so you knew where the actual overlapping photographs, or the stereoscopic part of the overlapping photographs were, was actually on the ground. And then you could put an air a point in that particular on the ground. Without seeing those photographs, without knowing where the actual overlap was, you had to put a point down to suit the ground survey. It's sort of had we'd have gone down in the Antarctic with the photographs in our hand, that would have been much better. Because we were down there where they were taking the photographs, there was no way we were going to make it absolutely right.
I think that lesson was learned later, wasn't it?
I think it must have been, yes, it must have been. It's we've learned a lot since those early days. Even like the Argentine Islands, which is in the northern part of Grand India Channel. Now, there's dozens and dozens of small islands in there. And it meant that if we had to do a ground survey, we would be months and months trying to survey all those islands from the ground. Now, hunting area survey, I got air photograph cover of that area or part of that area, but they hadn't completed everything.
Mm.
So what the Navy decided to do was send a helicopter up and take photographs from some helicopter. Now, a helicopter vibrates quite a lot and it's very shaky and it waves here and there. It won't keep on a definite course. And they took the whole line of photographs and I was able to plot those actually in sort of a rough position enough to prevent us from having to do a ground survey. So that's one of the things that the naval photography helicopter was able to provide for us, which was a great help. It's, they learned a lot from that, I think, because it meant that under certain circumstances, a helicopter can be used, and whereas before they said it was too unstable. But
at the end of your year at Prospect Point, did you feel as though you'd achieved everything you could have been expected to achieve?
No, nobody ever does that. It's one of those funny things that I think everybody that comes back from home said would say to themselves, "I wish I could have done better." It's this question of hindsight again, where you're eight on the unknown, you don't know fully what's going to happen, and you do something and you think it's right, and then when you come back home you say, "Well, no, I could have improved on that," sort of thing. So you're always left with this feeling that I could have done better. But you did well, this is it. You came up with an answer, and that answer has been better than what there was there before. But having the fact that it was better there before, perhaps not good enough for some people, you could have done it much more accurately had such and such a thing happened. You see, it's this question of hindsight again. It is a wonderful thing.
There's two more things I particularly want to ask you about, Fred. I know you came back from the Antarctic and carried on working for FIDS for a while.
That's right, yeah.
Bass.
Yeah. 2.5 years.
2.5 years. A lot of it was writing up the work you'd done down
That's
there.
That's right. Yeah. Well, a lot of it was surrounding aerial photographs.
What was your connection with the place naming committee?
Well, that was interesting because although I went up there for my own area, the Base O area and the Base J area, I think Brian Roberts, who was the head of the postal section, of the polar section at the Foreign Office, he was also secretary of the place names committee. He wanted somebody who would inspect the hunting aerial survey to find out whether or not certain place names were in the right place, whether in actual fact the previous expeditions that have been down there had got their quota of place names correct and all this business, and whether or not the photography shows up areas where there should be place names and there wasn't any. And he was a great one for being very pedantic in, he wanted absolute accuracy in the statements, etc. And I think probably he realised that he'd got hold of somebody that probably more or less had same similar thoughts that he had. Now, I was very, more or less, not exactly pedantic, but I like to be very accurate as far as possible, and not that sort of too critical of my own work, but I would hope that I would come up with a good answer. And the fact that I was in situation again, and he wanted somebody to do that particular work, he fought for me to be carried to stay on. Now, in my terms of reference, I was not allowed, apparently, I think it was something like 3 months I was given, and I had to return to the Ordnance Survey. And apparently, I think he had several letters to Sir Vivian Fuchs, I think, to try and keep me. And in the end, I think both of them won, in actual fact, and I was kept on for 2.5 years, solely on looking at the hunting aerial survey. That included areas like South Georgia and places like that. No, areas that I hadn't even visited. And as I say, I got a whole list of the place name sheets that I was involved in. I think it must be somewhere near 1,000 names, I suppose. And of course, I checked. So I had to check on the all the previous expeditions that had been down there, like those in the 1800s and things like this. And of course, all the information came back from Scott Polar down through the to Foreign Office. I saw the original charts and the original statements written up by some of these early explorers. And I had to deduce from what I saw on the stereoscope what they were describing. And I was able to probably pinpoint several places that hadn't been sort of fully recognised, and the name was probably misplaced in several places. And so they were determined that that was the particular spot where the name was originally given, and that was it.
So your concern was not choosing names, but placing them in the right place.
Place them in the right place. Also, as you say, naming features that require a name, because there were visual aspects which needed for reference points, for, say, for rescue points or for report writing and things like this.
Is there a wooden glacier or a Fred Nunatak?
There's Wooden Peak. And that is Holtertal Bay. That's at the bottom end of Grandidere Channel. That's what, I think it's 6,000 feet up, I think, or 9,000 feet. Quite a big one anyway, it's a peak.
Tell me about your role in the location of the US space.
Well, the US station, that was interesting because my address then was Hailing Avenue in Portsmouth, and then and I got a letter from the United States and Arctic people, and they were wanting to put a biological station somewhere in the Antarctic Peninsula, and they wanted to know also the what type of boat would be suitable for that particular area. Well, they must have read a report that in the Polar Record about John Wynne Edwards' party in the Grandidere Channel. And the only place that I could think of, as far as biological station was concerned, would be where there's a lot of islands. And that, to me, would be the Argentine islands, the northern end of the Grandidere Channel. And as far as the boat's concerned, I was more or less at a nonplussed. I didn't really know what sort of thing would be suitable in working through a little islands, etc. So I thought, well, I'd better go up and see Brian up in the Foreign Office. So I took the letter up to Brian in the Foreign Office and more or less discussed it and said, I can't help you, it's all yours. And Brian, obviously he knew that the Ambers Island station was becoming extinct shortly. So he suggested that there's a fact that it was very, very close to the Argentine Islands. Also the fact that the Bellingshausen Sea was next door, as it were, and the shipping could get in quite easily into that area, he suggested that perhaps they'd like to have a look at the end, the base end, the Ambers Island area for their biological station. And of course, right alongside you had a snow platform, which is also useful for short-range aircraft, which is another thing, or helicopters. So it turned out that it was an ideal location, really, for the Americans to take, which they did. But it was all Brian's work, really, not mine. I set the ball rolling, and I'm glad in a way, because the fact that the Argentine islands themselves, the base F, was taken over by the Russians, weren't they? It's the Ukrainian island, that's right. They are there now, which they're very, very pro-British, in actual fact. I was quite surprised about that.
I have one final question for you, and this is to do with the grave of Edward Bransfield, was located in Brighton. You've been there twice, and there was in 59 and again in 95.
That's right, yeah. That was another sideline that working with Brian up in the Foreign Office in the research department in Stanhope Street, and with Ina Thomas, who was his secretary. And one sunny day, we were up there working away, and Brian walked over to the window and looked down into the street below, and there was he suddenly said, "We'll all go to the seaside." And we wondered, what the heck's going on here? We didn't realise that had an Antarctic item to it. And they said, right, let's go. So we got into Brian's car. He took Ina back to her apartment to pick up some steer, and he went to his own apartment to pick up some stuff. Then he drove me to Clavering Avenue at Hammersmith to sort of pick up the camera, my own camera. That's where Wally Parker, Wally Herbert was. And we went off down the road down to Brighton. And I hadn't realised before, the year before they had been down there and they'd asked one of the staff down there where Bransfield Grave was, and he didn't know, but anyway, they searched and eventually found it. It was all covered in bracken and it was hidden. And so Brian decided that he would leave it all in their hands to clear it, and he would come down the following year, which is the year that I'm talking about. And we went down to see whether they'd cleared it or not, and we found that they had cleared it up to a point. And from then onwards, I took an interest in there because I don't know why. Mainly, I think, was the fact that I was probably living quite close to Brighton and they were up in London or something like that. I thought, I'll keep an eye on this and see what happens. And eventually I decided, I go down and have a look at it. And I went down to Brighton Cemetery by rail, and I couldn't find it. And I thought to myself, well, what's happened? I was sort of realised that there have been large clearance of graves, etc. And eventually, when I did find it, I found the actual line of grave next. They'd reached the next grave line Bransfield's grave itself.
So it was under threat, was it?
So I thought, well, it looks like it's under threat. So I surveyed it. I went down to Brighton Library and got the Ordnance Survey map out and sketched from the Ordnance Survey map, then went back to the cemetery and plotted its position and took the photographs, etc. And then I wrote to, I think it was Bob Headland, I think, in the Scott Polar, saying that could we get the Royal Commission on Ancient Monuments to put a clamp on it, put a protection order on it. And he wrote to them and asked about it. And they wrote back eventually and said that it was out of their remit, but suggested he contact the local diocese office about the importance of the grave. And which he did, and he got a reply back, and we were sort of wondering what was the next stage, and out of the blue came a request from Scott Polar, from a woman, Mrs. Sauter, asking for more information about her ancestor, Edward Bransfield. And this was completely out of the blue. Within a couple of weeks.
The guardian angel again?
And yeah, Angel John. Yeah, that's right. Because I said at the time, hey, where do we find a person that knows anything about it? And of course, a lot of letters have been passed since then, and I've helped her, in actual fact, to more or less make sure that the grave was renovated and the stone was sort of recut, as it were, and to make people aware that here was a man who probably first sighted or sort of plotted part of the Antarctic continent. But it's one of those things that the Duke of Edinburgh had to be involved. I got her to contact him, which he pulled one or two strings, I think, and contacted Trinity House and Worshipful Company of Shipwrights, etc. And they come up with the money for renovating the grave. And then we had the ceremony with all the local people, etc., the Dyson's office and Scott Polar and the Admiralty and Trinity Hayes, they all came and we had a ceremony over the grave, and that's how it stays at the moment. So, very pleased about that one.
It's a great story. Fred, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for your efforts, because I wouldn't have been able to do it otherwise.